Our presenters today for Hailing from the Foreign, the Plight and Delight of Embodying Cultural Change. We have Maggie Beers from San Francisco State University, Lee Rock from the University of Trinidad and Tobago, and Joseph Vaughn from Harvey Mudd College. The fourth advertised presenter, Jeffrey Trisiak, has had an emergency and was unable to attend, so won't be presenting. But we are bringing in Phil Long from University of Brisbane.
Queensland.
University of Queensland. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, small disembodied head right over here, and audio and everything else. So I will let you get started and move forward. Thank you. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for getting up so early to come. We wanted to have a fireside chat and discovered that the room didn't have a fireside. So we're sitting here, and we'd like to invite you to come as close as you feel comfortable so that you can see us. We also didn't want to PowerPoint at you. We're PowerPointing up there, and it's just looping, and it's just got some background information about us and some of the questions we're going to discuss this morning. We're also going to try and get you involved and ask you questions. And each of us has moved in a variety of ways in the last 2 years or so. And we discovered from talking to one another there were lots of similarities. Some of us had never met before. I met Maggie for the first time yesterday. And we decided we should maybe share some of the lessons we'd learned over the last 2 years. And our first question, our the first thing we're going to do is give an overview of the cultural changes we're going through at the moment, and Maggie's going to start with that.
Thank you, Joseph. So one of the linking common threads that we have together is it all goes back to the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada. That's where I met Uli, where I was a modern language doctoral student learning about teaching foreign languages, and my topic had to do with how do you teach teachers to use technology to teach culture. So culture has always been a really interesting part of our conversations, and Uli is also in the language area. And then one of the professors that we worked with is actually now the president of Joseph's university. So it's an interesting link. And so when we think about culture, it's something that I thought quite a bit about when I was working in the Faculty of Education teaching teachers about what is culture. And so there's several definitions of culture, and so I think it's useful to have those in our head as we talk about what cultural change means. And so if we think about, just using the example of foreign languages, we have the small C culture, which is the four Fs, the food, fairs, folklore, facts, and figures. And we have some of those facts and figures and up here on our slides. And then there's the high C culture, which the capital C, which is all the works of art and the literature, the museums, the art. And then there's also an anthropological point of view, which is looking at culture as a process and common understandings and systems. And so I think today we'll also talk about some of the systems and real changes that we've faced as we went from one place to another. And then the more emerging definition of culture that's becoming more and more thought about in all different types of literature and feminist literature and multicultural understandings is looking at culture as discourse or multiple points of view, and how when you really try to understand culture, you can really only try to put yourself in the shoes of another person and try to understand the perspective where they're coming from. And I think that multiple perspectives is what we'll be bringing here today, and thinking about how can we really use our cultural insights to understand and to create meaning, as Clifford Geertz would say. How do we weave these webs of significance between the multiple perspectives that we come across in our different universities, our different places? And so when we think about cultural change, it's true that I lived in Canada for 11 years, but I actually grew up in the Bay Area in California, and 25 years later, I find myself back there, and people constantly ask me where I'm from because I've picked up little accents in Europe and Canada. And so even in my own culture, I'm really seen as an outsider first. And so you really think about what is a culture. And so in my own days, I've come across so many different cultures, and we'll also be talking to that, of what does it mean to come from Canada to just down the coast to San Francisco, which is a culture unto itself. What does it mean to move from being a faculty member with some project management responsibilities to becoming a full-on administrator in a university culture? What does it mean to... I came from a polytechnic. After doing my doctorate, I was at BCIT, which is British Columbia Institute of Technology. That, for me, I think is the most pointed change, is moving from a polytechnic into a liberal arts college. And then finally, what does it mean to be... I work in academic technology, and here at this conference, we're constantly... I feel like the dominant culture at this conference is information technology. And so what does it mean to be the senior academic technology administrator in a culture that's really dominated by the understandings and notions and assumptions about IT? And so I think that that's some points that we'll talk on today.
So my name is Uli Rauch, and I moved from the University of British Columbia to the University of Trinidad and Tobago. So I'm really focusing on change in terms of changing not the organizational culture also only, but also, of course, a different cultural experience. And I want to focus right away on Phil. By the way, we if you happen to be typing, we can hear you type. Okay. Maybe, yeah, cool, thanks. I want to move forward, just quickly pointing out that an approach that I experienced as being very helpful is being a learner when you go into a new environment. And really, I'm looking here at transformational leadership that is nurturing what is there as opposed to come in there, and please consider the context. I come as a white middle-aged man into a predominantly black culture, and clearly you cannot be seen as the person who has the solutions, and indeed I don't have the solutions. I need to learn about the environment that I'm going to be working in. I need to find out what are the institutional business processes, what are the organizations. So the learning part is incredibly important, being able and open to learning, to understanding what is happening in the first place in your new environment. This is the only way you can get any credibility, or you achieve any legitimacy. I just want to actually pass on to Phil here. Phil, can you hear us? And just what is your experience moving into from MIT to Brisbane, Queensland?
Thanks, Yuli, and thanks also to Maggie and Joseph. Is my audio coming through okay?
Wonderful.
Okay. Coming down into the Australian environment is a little bit disconcerting insofar as it is very, on the one hand, superficially similar or familiar, being that it is an English-speaking country and it has the projection of one with a very laid-back environment and such. But at the same time, the longer one is here, the more the differences emerge. And some of the key segregators, some of the key differentiators become increasingly obvious. My role here at the university is actually switching hats from being more of an administrative person, as I had been in roles at MIT in their academic computing group, to a professor. So I'm a full professor of electrical information technology, electrical engineering, and have my own lab. And our responsibilities here are to do research around the impact of digital tools and learning. So part of my role here is a little bit different from one I have been accustomed to before. I want to underscore Yuli's comment about learning, because as I mentioned, the superficial similarities made initial assumptions about things here quick to make and entirely wrong. one of the first things I became painfully aware of is entirely new definitions for words I thought I knew. And that's because of their cultural context and the baggage or meaning that goes with them here. For example, equity turns out to be a very different, have a very different implication and a different meaning to one that I had been familiar with. Here, equity is all about making sure that things are done in a way that does not disenfranchise or otherwise make anyone in a group feel like they are less than equal, which on the one hand sounds perfectly fine. On the other hand, it tends to mean that if there's someone in the group that is doing a particular activity better or differently than someone else, then that's a problem for the rest. And that makes a lot of things much more challenging. So I think there's a couple of issues that I'd like to highlight. One is to the requirement, almost the obligation, to be much more self-reflective and much more questioning than perhaps one might have been accustomed to be in the past. And also, I think, to be much more searching and grounded in one's own perceptions of why you're there and what you're trying to accomplish. So I think those two things are particularly relevant to me. And finally, in terms of getting situated and organized, it was extremely important, I think, to have made careful and wise selections in the character of the people that I chose to surround me and have to hope and trust that they will help interpret these differences as they emerge before I do damage or they do damage to me. Why don't you take it from there?
Thank you, Phil. And although I moved physically just 50 miles, I moved from UCLA to Harvey Mudd, and that was from 37,000 students to 756, from the humanities division to engineering and mathematics and science, from a well-known brand name to Harvey Who, and to a culture in terms of work culture that was very different from UCLA. And so many of the things I discovered were quite similar to when I went and lived and worked in Spain for 7 years and discovered I had language barrier there too, but there were lots of things that I needed to learn by listening carefully and understanding that some of the things I did would be surprising changes for people and I wouldn't recognize that. So our next topic is the fact or the claim that higher ed institutions are often considered resistant to change. And we were all more or less explicitly asked to come and bring change to the organizations we were moving to. And we asked ourselves, well, are we crazy?
Well, so the resistance, and I alluded it to it already, is of course often grounded in existing practices that have been proved true. So in my particular case, and I'm a professor in education, I came to Trinidad, a new university, where a lot of people that had previously worked in organizations like in the private sector and the government were now recruited into the national university. And they began running the university as if it was a corporation. And so I really had to consider, I was really fairly hot-blooded initially, thinking this is impossible. Procurement processes were incredibly complicated. I did not understand that because this is a small island, everybody knows everybody, everybody has connections. If you don't have a procurement process that ensures that there's a fair process in allocating orders, somebody's nephew, brother-in-law, whoever, is going to get the job. And so all of a sudden, just to give you an example, my understanding or my tolerance for the way procurement was happening had to increase. And this is just one of these little experiences that, you know, you could say, oh, they're resistant to change. At the same time, you have to understand that your assumptions about how processes, business processes are to be run, or how academic processes are to be run, are not working because the context is different, coming back again to the learning. So when we say something like resistance is part of a culture, we need to understand the culture before we so freely label resistance and equating it with maybe people not willing to change. There might be often very rational reasons beyond it. You had a question.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, of course. And by the way, because you are not blank slates, you all have as many experiences as me, I'm not sure. So I would really invite you to participate.
I was wondering earlier if you could speak to the difference between learning formal differences versus informal differences. So, for example, learning the ropes of a procurement system, you know, what gets filed where, what the flowchart is, versus learning about so-and-so's cousin or so-and-so has been here for a long time. I'm wondering if you could speak to that balance, and if that balance makes sense to the rest of you guys, if you could say something more to that. If that's too big a question, I could take that later, too.
Quickly answer that. It's really the difference between learning to be and learning a system. And we're all pushing, a learning environment that is student-centered. That's the pedagogical approach that I take for sure. That is collaborative. And so part of it is really learning to be. Engineers need to learn how to be in an environment as an engineer besides their very substantive skills they need to acquire, for instance. Likewise, coming down there, I need to learn how to be part of that system. Much of it has to do with experience. I mean, you can formalize it. You can say transformational leadership, as I did early on. That is, like, I'm not trying to hit people over the head. I'm trying to motivate people. I try to bring them along, nurture them, find where are their strengths, where are the weaknesses that could be addressed. But it's the learning to be, and it has to do with a gut feeling almost. You got to sense out you are a stranger in a new environment, and you're using all your skills to kind of find your ways, your paths around there. So clearly there's two aspects, and I think the learning to be is very important. Phil, maybe?
Brian?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I'll take it from here then.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just following up. I was interested in, Yuli, your description of learning to be, because that's a favorite expression of John Seely Brown's, who uses it in the context of participating in the culture of whatever the discipline is as a practitioner. And I think one of the things that when you're newly introduced into a culture, one of the ways to find common ground is to, in fact, participate in the environment as an active member of whatever your disciplinary or professional role is. And so in my context, that sort of translates into essentially living your mission. I mean, you're there as a change agent, that's true, but you're on display and essentially engaging in that activity 24/7. And everything you do stands in relief just because of the newness that you have or the difference that you bring. And about the only way I know that you can sort of leverage that is to participate as deeply as you can in the practice that you're trying to demonstrate to others. And as a change agent, one of the things at least I'm trying to do is in the daily activities, in the questions, in the way in which I approach both problems and people, is to through my own actions, through my own inquiry, through my own expression, reflect the kind of engagement, the kind of approach that I believe, at least, that the institution has, in some sense, brought me there to try to incent. And so in that context, I think that you just have to live out the mission on almost a 24/7 basis. The comment was made earlier that higher ed institutions are resistant to change, and that's probably the understatement of the morning. Second only to the Catholic Church, I think higher education is one of the most conservative entities and institutions on the planet, and that has served it well in many respects, but it also means that it is a true mountain in order to try to move. And therefore, I don't think you can approach it from the perspective of trying to move much more than your immediate sphere of influence, and that's bounded by the immediate individuals that you're in contact with.
Brian, as you asked the question, I realized that even sometimes the distinction between formal and informal, the framework you bring, can be something that you have to question. And it's like even simple examples, like the formal might be to contact someone, you look them up in the directory. That was the framework I brought. And I kept running into the fact that, that was the formal instruction I got too. But I kept running into the fact that the online directory, I'd look someone up, I'd get their telephone number, and I'd call, and it wouldn't be them. And I go, what's going on here? Until I realized one day, someone actually told me, it's the paper directory you need to use. And, so that kind of, you had to just question what you thought you knew. Maggie, you wanted to say something.
Just a real quick follow-up. You all mentioned that you were brought to change, and now this kind of swings around to how can I become part of that culture but still be seen as that change agent. I've actually had to work at 7 different institutions as a change agent, and the balancing act is amazing because you have to be seen as, to the people you're serving immediately, as that I'm one of you, but from the person, the executive that maybe brought you in, that's not why I brought you here. How do you balance that?
That's a great question. I think we all have something to say about that.
We do. Yeah. We wanted to pull out some emerging themes, and I kind of jumped in my seat when I heard spheres of influence and now this, because I had written that down here as one point to talk about. Coming in as a change agent, we often do this in our teacher education programs as well, where we train our student teachers to go into the new schools and basically change everything with our new theories and activist curriculum that we teach them. And then what we finally realize is that we're sending the people with the less cultural capital into the schools to try to affect change. And I think that on the one hand, is something that we are facing, as well as coming into new institutions being change agents. So when we look at what is our cultural capital, or what's really currency in our new environment, we have, I think, the first 6 months or 1 year, we have the cultural capital, which is being from outside, and it's interesting that they went outside of the university to bring us in. So we have a certain cachet and a certain window of opportunity. But then at the other hand, we are in a powerless or less than powerful position, because we don't have the second piece of cultural capital, which I'm finding is really really important on our campus, which is loyalty and longevity. And that loyalty and longevity is something that you build over time. And so when Phil says that you're 24/7, it's all about building up those relationships, those interpersonal trusting relationships, and also the longevity of how many, you haven't been here for many months, but during those months you're putting in a lot of hours, spending time with people and being on with the social experiences. And so one thing I've had to realize as well is that we, even though I have my direct reports, and then I also have other people I'm supposed to coordinate, we can't control anybody. The only thing that we can do is influence. And so we have our spheres of influence that radiate out. And so I think in my environment, it's a very decentralized technology environment where I have my central unit, but then I'm also trying to affect some sort of influence in these various spheres. And so it is a very delicate path to walk.
I found that it's very helpful to be explicit about change, about the fact that you're going through change yourself and the people around you, and that there's a change curve going from resistance, denial, exploration, commitment. And actually, that helps understand why someone may appear to be resisting. And if you can get people talking about where they are on the change curve, and that they'll be in different places, perhaps on different days, and you'll be in a different place on different days. Now, it's a real challenge to get a group of IT folk talking about how they feel and where they are on the curve, but I think that's one of the big challenges when you're bringing change to an IT organization, is actually get people comfortable talking about things that aren't switches and knobs.
One comment I'd like to interject, it's a follow-up on what Maggie was saying about that second aspect of cultural capital. I think that at least one aspect of that, the investment that you're constantly making in building those relationships, and the depth that you have to go to try to pursue that, is all about, on the one hand, sort of demonstrating your own integrity, so that they see that you're someone that is worth their time. But more importantly, it's all about building the trust that allows you to get them to be willing to take a risk or a step based on some assertion or promise or other offer of support that you can make in order to try to make an incremental or, if possible, even a transformational change in their engagement with their students or with their program or with their own disciplinary work that leverages or takes advantage of the technology that you're there to work with. So that trust building exercise is a constant and one that I think underlies a lot of what we've been talking about.
We have a question.
I'd like to know how you made a judgment as you considered your job offers about whether just the person to whom you'd report was the person desiring the change, or how pervasive this was in the upper administration. Some of you made significant geographical moves, others who didn't still perhaps gave up job security in a time of economic turmoil. And if you arrive somewhere and find that there's support from your immediate supervisor, but not from others, and then that person changes jobs, leaves the institution, whatever, how much time do you like to know both your process and how much time you spend worrying now about whether that person who brought you in is going to leave?
This one feeds into, am I right? Is that connected? Yeah, I just speak to that, because exactly that situation has happened to me. I'm charged with setting up in an 8-campus environment a teaching learning center. That is, I really need to look at the professional development as well as instructional technology. So Blackboard comes under, you know, my mandate, as well as online course evaluations, dealing with a student information system that's not there, and so on and so on. So I got hired to put all these things in an envelope in a place by a provost who is leaving. And so it was very important to me at the time that I had some modicum of job security, which was, I went down there for a year, and then really what kicked in. And I think that's the point that Phil was alluding to, that Maggie was alluding to, was that the attractiveness of the job increased because I realized that I was actually there with a mission and I have a passion for it. I contribute with my group that is being built to the changing of the learning environment in Trinidad, because when we are educating teachers to become more student-centered in their delivery, that trickles down into secondary and primary education, and we are really starting a significant change. I wouldn't say a revolution, but a significant change. Now, I had always got the sense that this was a promise, but I realized they were serious about it. And when my staff realized that I was becoming very serious and engaged and passionate, I became like, I wasn't a change agent, I'm not a change agent, I'm just becoming a colleague that they trust, that has some experience. And then all of a sudden, the question really about job security, I personally wasn't all that worried about anymore, because it was incredibly exciting, or it is incredibly exciting, to be participating in change and actually see change. So that gives you, again, a lot of credibility and legitimacy, and you draw on that. So I'm learning. It's a learning process for myself, but it has also reinvigorated my life, my professional life.
In my situation at San Francisco State, I had an all-day 12-hour interview the first time, and I met so many different people. And then I requested to go back again because I still had some doubts, and I wondered why certain people I hadn't been introduced to, and I wondered what that was all about. And so I went back and asked to specifically meet with all those people. And so I felt really confident when I went there that it was deeper than just the person I report to. And we have had a change in our provost, but I still feel that there's enough undercurrent of understanding that this was an important position. But one thing I wanted to point out is, as we move from one place to another, I had done a leadership program called the Chair Academy before I took this position, and all of us mentioned how important those particular Fry Institutes or leadership mentorship programs were in helping us make the proper decision. And this was a one-year program with a one-week cohort face-to-face, one year, and then another week face-to-face. And so that was leading up to my job, to looking for this actual job. And what I found as a result of that year was, and the message was very clear, that it's not about the job and the report and your job description. It's about, it's a full body experience changing professions. And one thing that they made sure was that we put down a mission statement for ourselves and a five-year plan, not only for ourselves as professionals, but ourselves as individuals, and also for our families. And I had never written down a five-year plan for my kids or my family. And that's when it became very clear that it was a really good move to move back near my family after 25 years away. And so the job is important, but if we're burnt out, or we don't have the support structures, or if you're only going there for the job and the recognition from your superiors, it's not an appropriate embodiment or cultural change. It really has to be your whole diverse, complex, individual person that's making that decision, personal, professional, and family. And so I think that that has really helped us through all the weather all of the changes, because I think you have that support structure in place.
I think we'll move on with one of our own questions next. We asked ourselves, are there any techniques to change the tide of an organization's culture? Phil, do you want to?
Would you repeat that, please?
Are there any techniques you can use to change the tide of an organization's culture?
I'm not sure that there are techniques per se beyond some of the strategies, if you will, that we've sort of talked about. I do think that it is a change of this magnitude, at least certainly the change of the magnitude that I made, moving whatever 25,000 miles away, really requires that you're doing this both out of a commitment but also out of a sense of adventure. And I think the techniques that you leverage when you're trying to get others to change their point of view or step outside their frame of reference to an area where they're living on the edge of their comfort zone is largely about bringing, I mean, you are a wealth of, you have a lot of assets. You have a lot of resources, a lot of experience, and a lot of colleagues that you can bring to bear, so that you're not the single voice in the wilderness making an assertion or a suggestion about something. I think it's really important that as you find yourself in this new situation, that you, in a sense, bring an entire community of people with you, and you leverage that on a regular basis. I mean, I don't know how many times I've been here when I've relied on calling people from all over the planet to give me a hand, to ask people to that I'm talking with to, well, hear another voice about this, someone who's got experience at this, about this at and Saskatchewan, for example, or a colleague at Stanford. So it's not just you as representing a point of change, it's rather you as representing part of a wave of change. And so if there's a technique at all, it's to some extent to envelop yourself in the community that you've built over the years, and to do so with a full sense of trust and commitment in your friends and your colleagues who you know are going to be there to help you and to represent the points of view, and even correct you if they think you're wrong. And that, I think, is an invaluable resource and asset and technique to make the efforts that you're making have greater traction.
I found that there were several things that helped. Like, for instance, for the last 2 years, I've been introducing myself to people and saying, I'm the new CIO, and I can get to say I'm new for at least 2 years, and kind of explicitly marking that I was new to them, even if I knew them personally for the last year, I'm still the new CIO, and that letting people know there was stuff I needed to learn. Another thing that I found really useful was to, in order to begin building partnership between the staff and the staff that report to them, to be very explicit about agreements and to change the conversation from you need to do X to can I get your agreement to do this? And if you say yes, you're committing, and if you need to renegotiate, that's okay. And we will renegotiate, so that you move yourself from being the person in the room and all the people are looking in the window at you to getting them in the room and agreeing with you that, that this is the direction you want to go in. And just while I was here, I had the psychological feel of having an agreement being broken while I was away, and I was in a different psychological place than I often had been in the past, where people who reported to me hadn't done something that would do. I didn't feel like, okay, I've got to wag my finger. I felt like I've been stood up here. The agreement has been broken, and I'm sure they'll feel the same way if I break an agreement. So you're building a kind of relationship that's different from the traditional hierarchical supervisorial vision. Maggie?
So one strategy that I found very useful is when you're trying to change a culture is to really try to identify what that culture is and have everybody come to some common understanding about their assumptions and their beliefs. And so I led various groups through activities to really try to document what are the core values, what is the mission, what is the purpose. And sometimes I was seen as being very corporate in doing that, but I think at the end that was my role, and it led to some greater understanding. And so by just actually documenting and coming to some common language, that really helped articulate what some of the issues were. So then it wasn't actually me making the change, it came from within. And so I wrote, I had a retreat with my whole staff where we identified what the challenges were and came up with some understandings, and also helped describe ourself. So the various teams described to the other teams what their function was and what their mission was. And I think that was the first time that core team had actually thought about what their mission was. So not only did they come to greater understanding of themselves, then they were able to communicate it to the others. And so I think self and other is a constant learning experience to help bring about the cultural understandings. So.
Okay. Changing individual minds and groups of minds and dealing with naysayers.
Well, you know, there again, I don't know if you ever heard about the term positive deviant. That is somebody who actually works in an organization, and it was, I think it came up in the keynote actually yesterday, in fact, the keynote, of course, addressed a whole lot of issues that we are talking about here. It was an excellent keynote, I thought. So the positive deviant is the person who, under conditions of constraint, or persons under conditions of constraint, will come up with a solution to make a process working, whatever process that may be. And of course that develops in every kind of organization. And rather than castigating them, I'm, again, in this whole spirit of a transformation and leadership, I'm trying to rope them in, to bring them, in terms of John Collins, to bring them on the bus and see where are their strengths. Because clearly, those people were very creative. So when we talk about naysayers, I want to redefine that a little bit and look at an aspect of people who are resisting change because they have found a solution that may work for them. And again, I'm very sensitive. I'm a sociologist by trade, by the way. So I'm very sensitive to the environment that I'm working in. And I want to capture the institutional memory and the knowledge of the people who are there. So I'm really supporting a bottom-up approach. And it's really by being inclusive that I'm, and by communication, of course. And it sounds very fussy saying that, but by constantly talking with each other in formal and in informal ways, that I'm trying to keep everybody on board as opposed to weeding out those who are deemed to be useless. And this is of course in times of constraint where basically in North America as much as in the Caribbean, there is so much of a freeze going on that you can't replace anybody. If anybody leaves the job, you can't rehire and so on and so on. So, but it's really capturing the creativity of those who found new solutions and see to what extent are these solutions something that could be in principle integrated in a broader vision. Again, empowering these people who have been trying to find solutions rather than pushing on them an assumption about or a process that may work in a different cultural context.
One piece about change is that we are not the change, it's the institution is the one that actually is the changed entity. So I think that we need to think about what it will look like if we weren't there. And that's when we really know if change has happened or not. And so as a leader, I have no intention of leaving San Francisco State. I think I'll have a long career, but I'm immediately preparing for my departure as part of being a leader. And so I think that as a leader, you have to constantly prepare for not being there anymore. And that's what I did from the first day, was look around and try to set up systems where it's not dependent on me, where it's really self-supporting and where people feel empowered and have the voice to actually make their decisions and to live and to lead what their passion is. And so part of that was setting out just a clear vision, and of course I had influence on this, but really creating a brand for academic technology. And then my slides, I think you'll see, it's a really nice graphic. I'm all about look and feel because I have a multimedia background. So we created a look and feel for our unit. And I'm not the one making every decision, but the unit knows that they are part of a brand and there's certain expectations that are, and standards that need to be carried out in order to meet that brand. So it's not me anymore, it's about having a stake in this collectively created brand. And the other piece is to realize as a leader that sometimes in order to prepare for our departure, we also have to prepare our staff for a departure as well. And so I'm an educator and I look at that while I'm leading my staff, is sometimes I need to be a director and make some decisions, but sometimes I need to be an educator. And when I look at my bus, and at first I saw a lack of skills in certain areas based on my assumptions going in, but what I realized was, okay, I need to teach these skills, and I need to find opportunities for them to acquire these skills so that when I'm not here, they'll be able to either do it, or if they have to leave, they'll be able to get another job, and they can speak proudly of where they came from. So I think really learning to play to the strengths of the people on your bus, really setting high expectations and an understanding about the brand and the goals, and then ultimately just preparing to not be there anymore.
We've only got 8 minutes left, so we're obviously not going to cover everything we hope to cover. And I thought we might move to the question about resources. Each of us has included, and we'll put the slides up on the EDUCAUSE side, a set of resources. We asked ourselves the question, are there some things that were meaningful to you during the transition and that really helped? And we didn't want to give you a long, long reading list, so we tried to pick things that were meaningful. So among the things I chose is an article called SCARF, S-C-A-R-F, from a journal oddly named the Neuro Leadership Journal. And it's about the brain functions around flight and embracing things that are important when you're building teams. And the SCARF in question stands for status, certainty, autonomy, relatedness, and fairness. And the article is full of little gems about how you might be threatening status in a certain situation, and so you have someone arguing for an impossible position because the brain mechanisms that cause flight kick in. It gives you a sense of understanding what might be happening when you're in a difficult situation, and also helps you have ideas about what to do in order, say, to increase certainty. And one of the things I found very valuable was to be able to say to people, here's the general direction. Let's just all acknowledge that I don't know what it means in detail to make our services more reliable, but can you live with the uncertainty, and I'll work to lower it as much as possible with time. And so we gradually got to a point where people could say, yeah, there is uncertainty, but I know each day there's going to be more. And so I believe I'm tapping into the neurological basis of the liking for certainty that we all have.
And you know, I just want to ask Phil in a moment too, but since he didn't know that we were looking for resources, maybe Phil, give you a chance to think for a moment what kind of resource you may want to share. But while you do that, I want to just respond actually to something that Brian said in his presentation yesterday, that there seems to be a federal law to have URLs as a resource at the end of every presentation. So I decided not to come up with a URL. Again, if you're interested in the concept of a positive deviant, the Harvard Business Review has quite a few interesting articles written about it. It's a concept that came up in the early 90s by a number of professors from Tufts University. I think Seitlin was one of them, Stirner the other. And other than that, the whole notion of transformational leadership, I think it is really a choice that you make to become a gentle and intuitive and basically a caring leader, as opposed to be the new broom that comes in at stage four, again, as John Collins was talking about yesterday, that is supposed to save some kind of organization and therefore attempts radical changes, hurting a whole lot of people, not only the ones that are left out, but also that the ones that are inside the organization. So again, I really look at these more positive concepts of change and find them very convincing.
Phil?
Yeah, yes, Gesundheit. there are a couple of things I think that are important. I think part of the question, if I heard it correctly, Vaughn, was resources that you either had or brought with you or negotiated as part of the transition. Is that correct?
Resources of any kind that you found meaningful in the transition, people.
Right. A couple of things immediately, at least from my perspective, stood out. One is that I think. Maggie referred earlier to the fact that most of us in one fashion or another have been through some kind of a leadership program of one sort or another. And I think I have to underscore that was extremely helpful for me, because it part of the challenge that you have and you're moving into a new situation like this is there are times when you're by yourself and you're thinking, what in the world did I do? You're far away from anything that's familiar, and you know you may have a spouse or a partner with you, and that just simply adds to the questioning, because they're looking at you thinking, well, you got me into this, and you're standing there. And I think benefit that emerges from some of these leadership programs is the self-reflection and understanding of your own strengths and weaknesses, and leveraging those things in your own both personality and your own resource pool that helps you in this context. In an external sense, I mean, I was quite fortunate in the fact that when I was negotiating to identify the position that I have, I really didn't have any interest in being here, which is a great position to negotiate from. Which what that means is that I was interested in the idea, but I was also extremely content and quite happy with the position I had been in. And so I wasn't fleeing anything. In fact, the new position had to really attract to draw me away from something that was quite comfortable. And that, I thought, was important. And the second thing is that there are a couple of resources that I've always found helpful. And one in particular is the lessons that emerged from a set of readings that we did in our leadership program about Ernest Shackleton's journey. And you've probably all heard and or read about that story. But there are some leadership messages and leadership strategies that emerge from a close reading of that, which are just incredibly powerful. And among them include the importance of picking your team or assembling your team that you're moving into this new space with. And there's lots of different various leadership groups or books or what have you that are all use various phrases around that, picking the right people to be on the bus if you happen to be in the good to great crowd, or in Jackleton's case is simply putting your staff ahead of you, putting your community, your team ahead of you, because their success is your success. And I think that's an incredibly important resource to draw on and lesson from this. The last thing I wanted to note was just to hearken back to Joan's comment earlier, asking about the fragility of the position and the leadership environment. And there is an extreme difference in hierarchy in this new environment that I'm in. And it's a hierarchy that is palpable as you move up, talking with academic staff, which they mean by that faculty, through deans or executive deans and into the vice chancellors and deputy vice chancellors. And I think one of the things that's important is to both acknowledge the hierarchy but have absolutely no respect for it. And by that I mean by being honest and true in all of these levels and treating each individual you deal with the same level of concern and the same level of attention. I think what you're doing is sort of flattening that hierarchy and in the process empowering those that you're working with at different positions in it. So I think I'll leave my comments at that.
So just to build on that, I would also like to say that I had a really excellent job at BCIT. I was very happy there, and I think that really helped me find a baseline of what I should be able to expect in my new environment. So that helped me set certain expectations for work-life balance and all of that with my staff. So certain books that came to me at the right moment were Managing Technological Change by Tony Bates. That's a good Canadian, and that was really helped me. That was one. I'm not saying that these are the books that you should go out and read, but they were the books that touched me at the right time in my transition, in my progression. And so that one was one of the first ones I came into that was helpful for me. Then another book, which was more pop culture, was Transitions, Managing the Difficult Moments in Your Life. It just helped with the whole embodiment with family, friends, professional life. It talks about different phases. Of the first phase is identifying the letting go, grieving phase, and then the chaos phase, and then the new beginnings phase. So it gave some strategies on just how to deal with the different emotions that you might not expect. Another one was this idea of servant leadership, which Phil was talking about, that you're there for the people that you're working with. And this one was how to build creative teams, improve morale, get bottom line performance. I mean, who doesn't want that to happen in your team? And so I found that to be helpful, and it touched on the keynote speaker's points as well. And then finally, one that came to me while I had just started my job at San Francisco State was a really excellent article in EDUCAUSE, which was defining the SATO, which is the Senior Academic Technology Officer. And it really just did a job description of this emerging discipline of academic technology and the leadership that needed to be in place for that SATO on campus. And so I was able to use that to validate why I was there, and also to use it to communicate to others on campus of, see, EDUCAUSE says it's important for me to be here, this is an important role, and it just helped build that common understanding and language.
Okay, well, we're a little over time, but so thank you again very much for sharing some of your experiences with us, and Phil, thank you very much as well, and it's now apparently 2 a.m. tomorrow morning, as I understand it, so good night. And again, thank you, and please remember evaluations.